This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Unlike other pods, we are not guilty of recency bias. So from Monday, when Manchester United became genuine title contenders, to Wednesday, when Manchester United suffered defeat in their opening Champions League game. Poor decisions on the pitch and off it against a spirited young boys team who celebrate with such joy. No joy for Barca since holiday is finally over, so we can ask him all the questions from the Nou Camp. Bayern cruise past them. Elsewhere, cut and paste Lukaku is the difference for Chelsea from the previous pod. We'll round up all of the night's games. In the Premier League, we give Troy Townsend his pod debut on Monday, and Andros wallops one in hours later. Coincidence or a sign that we actually run football? All that plus Meet Awards with Kevin Keegan, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Ed Ahrens, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Good morning, Max.
And Sid Lowe. Hello, mate.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm good. You've been on holiday a long time, Sid. And lots of things have been happening in Spanish football. And I keep saying, can you come on? And you keep sending me pictures of beaches.
Yeah.
But you're back.
It was the only justified response to your basic stalking of me while I'm supposed to be on holiday. I even sent you a photograph of the dog in the car to say I was coming back so I could make the pod the next day. And then you didn't want me. So, yeah, no. I came back a day early to be with you. And you didn't care. You threw it back in my face, Max. It's not right.
It is worth saying, of all the panellists, you are the one that would leave a blue-ticked WhatsApp the longest. That's all I'm saying. You know, if there is a diva in the Football Weekly world, it is Sid Lowe.
Hey, I can you turn those blue ticks off?
Don't give him ideas.
I don't trust anybody who turns the blue ticks off. Anyway, before we get to Barcelona, let's start in Bern. Johannes emailed us last night, footballweekly@theguardian.com, if you'd like to email us. I'm a young boys Burn fan from my very first moments, he says. Went through most of the big moments of the club, and tonight we've crushed Manchester United. Man U, the Manchester United. I've never thought this would be possible. Clearly the red card has helped a lot, but still, it's crazy. A club like ours would in no statistical model beat a club like Man U, but we did it. Isn't that the beauty of football? I am very looking forward to tomorrow's pod. And Lars, those scenes at the end, and they went on for ages and ages and ages with the players sitting down and standing up and the crowd just staying there, was absolutely glorious, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was tremendous. And the feeling you got through the TV anyway was that there was a sense of relief almost, because they will have known that this was their chance to beat the mighty Man United at home, and not just because of the red card, because I thought they were right at it almost the entire game. They didn't look intimidated at all, and when the red card happened, you can see the whole body language of the players and from David Wagner on the bench, like, we can do this, you know, we have a chance here. But then the winning goal never came, you know, as the half progressed. Yeah, they had a lot of chances, and they just couldn't get the final goal. And in the end, they got a tidy little assist from Jesse Lingard and got a much, much deserved 2-1 win.
It was the commentator's curse on BT in the UK, wasn't it? Martin Keown saying how well United had defended, and then Jesse Lingard playing the ball through. United have lost 7 of their 11 Champions League matches under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He said, this is football at the highest level. Lack of concentration makes a mistake and you get done. I mean, it isn't, with all due respect to young boys, Ed, this isn't football at the highest level. And actually, even with 11 and 11, young boys look quite good in this game, I thought.
Yeah, I thought they were very impressive. And, you know, they picked on United's weakness, which everybody knows is in central midfield. And they really, really dominated the game from there. I think a lot of United fans will be quite concerned with the way that Solskjaer reacted to, you know, the situation just by, you know, switching to a back three, which clearly didn't work at the start of the second half. Just increased the pressure on them, really. And I think they've only kept one clean sheet in their last 11 Champions League games or under Solskjaer. So that is a real indictment of their, you know, their form under him in Europe. And yeah, it's they made it very difficult for themselves, because obviously you've got Villarreal and Atalanta in this group who are, you know, not going to be easy to get past, especially going away to them. And obviously United had problems against Villarreal in the Europa League final last season. So they've made it really difficult for themselves again. And it's adding pressure onto Solskjaer already that he, you know, doesn't need at this stage of the season.
Matt the Octopus says, can anyone on the pod make a case that it was Ronaldo's fault that United lost to Young Boys? The narrative must be supported. Johnny Liu writing, Ronaldo was not helping himself. Early in the second half, he threw himself to the ground again when he realised he would not be getting a penalty, and thereafter played in the sort of prize funk that either ends in a spectacular 30-yard bicycle kick or, as here, a series of ever more elaborate dives. Lars, the narrative, please.
Listen, he is an incredible goal scorer who doesn't do much in any other phase of the game, and we know that. But if you then go down to 10 men away in Europe, even against Young Boys, you know, he's probably... Maybe if you can get the ball to him near the goal, he might get you out of trouble, but he's not going to do much else. And Man United were completely overrun in midfield, and it just wasn't his game. I honestly thought, you know, Solskjaer could have been stronger and substituted him much earlier to get someone who would put a shift in instead. But I understand, of course, there's political ramifications to taking off Ronaldo early when you're in a bit of trouble. It's a difficult thing for him to do politically. So he, you know, Ronaldo is who he is, and you just have to deal with that. He does seem to have put the hex on all goalkeepers, Ronaldo. As the third goal he scored, that really, I think, a good goalkeeper should have kept out. So that is a valuable quality, I think.
Daniel had this question: has Ronaldo paid off every goalkeeper in Western Europe to ensure a successful return to Manchester United?
No, maybe he has. There's some sort of witch's brew involved here. We have experience with that on the pod. Maybe that's what's going on. Or just that. Actually, if we're being serious, there's a thing to be said. I mean, we go on and on about how younger players should learn from him and stuff. There's a case to be made that he is actually quite good at making sure he works the goalkeeper. You know, when he has a chance to finish, he gets them on target. And you give the goalkeeper a chance to mess up, I guess, is a way of looking at it. And so far, they've been, you know, happily doing that.
What should Solskjaer have done? I think it's interesting. I don't disagree with the sentiment that, you know, his in-game management isn't great. But Pep got it wrong in the Champions League final. Like, good managers also do that. Or Solskjaer might be a good manager. You know, it just seems an easy stick to beat him with, or maybe it's the right stick to beat him with.
Yeah, it was a difficult one to, you know, obviously going, that they were in a difficult ground and the atmosphere was really intense. And it wasn't an easy situation going down to 10 men 10 minutes before half time. And, you know, but I just think that the decision to go to three at the back just kind of invited on the pressure, really. And perhaps he should have just taken off Pogba maybe and brought on Matic a bit earlier, made it a bit more solid in the middle and just tried to get a bit more possession and hit them on the break. But you could almost hear Jonathan Wilson saluting and chinking his glass when that last goal went in, couldn't you? You could almost hear him.
But can't surely people have to stop being so stupid? I mean, really, are anyone surprised that in a game at home? Are anyone surprised that in a game at home against Newcastle, in which United create a lot of chances, Ronaldo scores two goals? No one's surprised by that. Are we surprised by in the game where they go down to 10 men and they get overrun in midfield, Ronaldo doesn't help you much? No, that shouldn't be surprising either. Can we just, like, whether you love Ronaldo or hate him, can at least be realistic about what he brings to the pitch and in what situations he's going to be very useful and in what situations he might not be as useful? That shouldn't be hard for grown-up people.
Yeah, but if we're not allowed to state the bleeding obvious, then this podcast doesn't have a long shelf life.
It's true. That would be a real threat to the viability.
Andrew says, who will be the first United player to crack and go and eat dessert? This is off the back of Lee Grant, the reserve goalkeeper, on TalkSport saying, this was Friday night in the group hotel. You finish your dinner, and usually on a Friday night, you've got some cheat stuff out. You've got some apple crumble, or you've got a bit of brownie and cream or whatnot. I tell you now, not one player touched the apple crumble and custard. Not one player went up for that brownie, because everybody was sat down and one of the lads said to me, what has Cristiano got on his plate? So we were having a little goosey gander at what he's got. And obviously it's the cleanest, most healthy plate you can imagine. It just cracked me up how not one single player dared get up and have that junk food that was laid out. And it's important to remember, it was not long ago that we got the menu, and Diogo Dalot was having a creme brulee, as was Nemanja Matic. Juan Mata was having a cheesecake. Anthony Martial was on the creme brulee. Harry Maguire was having a sticky toffee pudding. And Brandon Williams was having a cheesecake. And now none of them. Imagine having that power. Anyway.
I think that the reference point for me here, if you still want the dessert, you should do what Robert Lewandowski does, which is to eat the dessert first.
Yes.
Robert Lewandowski's wife is a nutritionist and has explained to him that in terms of, you know, digesting everything, having the dessert before the main meal is actually much better, and you can get away with having some dessert if you do it that way.
When I was a student, or alternatively a twat, we one day had this thing called a whole day backwards. And you have to start by opening a can of Grolsch and having one sip and putting it by your bed and then leaving it there. and then having a kebab, right? God. And then having some wine, having a few beers, then having dinner, right? And then you had lunch, and then you ended with a bowl of cornflakes. I don't know if we got through it, but like the idea of it at the time was hilarious. Now I can't think of anything worse. Also in this group, Villarreal drew with Atalanta. It was a good fun game this last, wasn't it? And very early in the group, but it is now not cut and dried for Manchester United.
It's not. I mean, Atalanta are one of those teams, like if you're not sure what to watch and nothing's really grabbing you, just watch whichever game Atalanta is involved with. I mean, they're rarely boring. They attack in a very wholehearted manner. They're sometimes a little bit iffy at the back. I thought it was very symptomatic for the game that the equalising goal was scored by the left wing back, who for some reason was the furthest forward when a cross came in the 83rd minute, and that really does sum up Atalanta and the way they go about their business. But I thought Villarreal did rather well, actually, in coming back here. Given that they were 19 points off qualifying for the tournament through the league last season and got there because of their escapades in the Europa League, I thought they looked very much on a good level here, Sid.
It's very much a Villarreal result, by the way. Villarreal draw all the bloody time. All the time. The last year, I think last season, I think it was 13 in La Liga. I think I'm right in saying they've drawn every game so far. This season, there is the beginnings of not a doubt as such, because of course Emery's won something with them, and they never won anything in their history, and their league position was possibly about right. I don't think many people would have demanded more. Some people would have expected a little bit more, but no one would have demanded more. But there is still that thing of sometimes that doubt about whether Villarreal take that extra step, and you know, sort of really go for victories as much as they could.
To the Nou Camp then, Barcelona 0, Bayern 3. No shots on target for Barcelona. First defeat in the opening Champions League game for 24 years, is it? All with Messi not there for the first time since 2004. Ronald Koeman had said, this will be an interesting game to draw conclusions about where we are. It felt really sad to me, Sid.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of it. I mean, another stat, by the way, which I didn't realise last night when I was writing, but was told afterwards. Barcelona had gone 38 games without losing a Champions League game at the Camp Nou, which is a club record. They've now gone three in a row losing at Camp Nou in the Champions League. Admittedly, obviously, those are against three very good sides. I think it's Juventus, Bayern and PSG. But you're right. I think that was the feeling last night, I think, was one of inevitability. And yet the curious thing was, for about 15 minutes, Barca played quite well. And that almost helps define this for you as well, because Barca played really well. It was really noisy. One of the best atmospheres I've heard at Camp Nou for a long time, because I haven't been any fans for 18 months. But it actually felt like there was a real sense of, OK, let's make this worthwhile. And for about 15, 20 minutes, you could feel people in the stadium thinking, bloody hell, we're not that bad. This is all right. Oh, no, it's not. And once Bayern had stepped into the game, I think there were lots of things that were striking about this. But one of them was how deep Barcelona ended up. They were playing with a five-man defence or a three plus wing-backs, however you want to define it. That defence ended up being stuck right inside its own penalty area really early on and never finding a way out. The two at the top of the pitch were just miles away. And there was this, I think there was a kind of a sense that, all right, so what we do now is we kind of cling on and let's see if we can get through this. And that was the height of their ambitions. There was a recognition, I think, that we're just not as good as this lot, and so we hang on. I actually managed to take a photograph of the second goal, literally of the moment the ball was going in, and I wasn't trying to, because I looked up and I was really kind of conscious of, wow, every single Barcelona player, apart from Memphis Depay and Luke de Jong, is within a metre of their penalty area. And it had been like, it wasn't just that it happened and I wanted to take a picture of it at that moment. It had been like that for the whole of the second half, and this was about, what, 7 or 8 minutes into the second half, I think. The Barcelona were right in their area. And at the point at which I was looking at it, Luke de Jong, who's obviously one of the two forwards, It's like he looked back and thought, bloody hell, these boys are going to need a bit of help. And he started trotting back. And it's not a criticism, by the way, that he was trotting, you know, not sprinting. It was like he'd realised, well, even with everybody there, they still can't bail out enough water here. So he was trotting back to the area where he arrived just in time to see the second goal from close range. And that kind of summed it up.
I mean, there was that moment where Luke de Jong was put through, but it is not a criticism of Luke de Jong. He's not a player that plays off the last man and goes through. But he looked slower than me. And I've got no meniscus in my left knee. And you were like, if you're a Barcelona fan and you're sort of... I know they were missing a lot of players as well. There are mitigating factors, aren't there? You know, if you're missing Dembele and Aguero and Fati, that is a different Barcelona, right?
Yes, of course it is. Of course it is. And it may well be that with time, some of these things start to fall into place. But yeah, you're right. And there was that moment when he was running off the ball, but he didn't seem to be running at all. But I think, again, I mean, this takes us kind of to the analysis of the whole game in a way. What we saw last night sort of wasn't a shock. But in a way, it was shocking that it wasn't a shock. That, you know, this is just what it is. And with Luke de Jong in that moment, that's just what he is. If you play a ball into space for Luke de Jong to run onto, that's just not what he does. And a bit like Lars was saying about Cristiano Ronaldo, there are some things you know you're going to get from him, and some things you know you're not going to get from him. And with Luke de Jong, you're not going to get a guy bursting through onto a through ball. It's just not going to happen. This is summed up perfectly by Gerard Piqué's phrase after the game, which was, en lo que hay somos lo que somos, which sort of translates as, well, it's just what it is, and we are who we are. And that's basically the case. I was trying to think of the best translation for it. It is what it is. I suppose that's the way it is, which I believe was a song.
Bruce Hornsby in the Range.
That's the one.
So you've got right, it can either be Bruce Hornsby in the Range, it's just the way it is, or it is what it is, I think, is what everyone says on Love Island. So it depends on...
And also, it is what it is the phrase that people tried to destroy Valverde with after the Liverpool result. And he said, well, it's lucky I... And actually, really, that's just a set phrase in Spanish. So, you know, it's happened. What can we do about it? You know, it's done now. And people were laid into him as if to say, you know, that's a defeatist attitude. Well, they've just been defeated.
I'm very worried to learn that, Max, because it's a phrase I probably use a lot, and I'd never watched Love Island, and I'd like to...
But maybe you could go on next series, Lars.
That would probably, yeah... I don't think people are ready for that.
You're saying you've never watched Love Island? No, but they have clearly listened to you repeatedly. That is why.
Massive in the Love Island community. Yeah.
It's really strange that episode of Love Island when they're all talking about Bodo Glimt. Yeah. And it was really strange.
I would tune into
understand.
That, to be fair.
Yeah, of course you would. Can you just... Because when you were away, you know, there were so many times we could have done like an hour special on the pickle that Barcelona are in. What is the latest stage of the pickle with, you know, Koeman and Laporte and everything?
That's exactly. That's the thing that was kind of provided the backdrop for this game, was, you know, beyond the reality that everybody knows, beyond the injuries that you've mentioned and the fact that Barcelona don't have... You know, Barcelona lost 8-2 to Bayern Munich. When was it? 13 months? Only 13 months ago. It feels like a very long time ago. Only 13 months ago. And they lost all three forwards since then. So, you know, the likelihood of them being good is not very high. But the latest, as you say, is the Laporta Koeman thing. Koeman has been quite honest and quite direct in an interview with Dutch TV, in which he said a line that has upset people. He said, you know, Barcelona have got a future because of me, thanks to me. And what he meant was, which sounds very overblown, what he meant was, you know, I'm playing these young kids and these young kids will come through and, you know, give them time. But it was very bluntly said. But also he talked about the relationship with Laporta, who, for those who don't remember this, or for those who never heard it because I was on holiday all the way through the summer and never told you this. In the summer, Laporta basically said publicly, well, yeah, Koeman's my manager, but give me a couple of weeks to see if I can come up with something better. I mean, it wasn't exactly said in those words, but that is essentially what he said. And Koeman knows that. And Koeman clung onto that position. Why? Because he wants to be Barcelona manager. But it's clear that he is basically there because there wasn't the money or the alternative for him not to be there. And obviously, how do you resolve that? Well, you resolve that by winning things and getting things right. But the reality of the situation of the club at the club at the moment is that that's not very possible. And it doesn't feel like this is going to end well between the president and the manager.
Meanwhile, Ed... Bayern are a really good football team, aren't they?
Yeah, it was great to watch them. I tuned into this game for most of it, actually, and I just to see how good they were, and obviously see how bad Barca were is a bit of a curiosity, really, for especially with Barca were concerned. But I was really impressed with Musiala again. Yeah. Every time I see him, just wow, he's getting better and better, isn't he?
He's lovely to watch as well, because even in those moments when he's not doing very much, he does it elegantly. His movement's really nice.
He really glides with the ball.
Yeah, he's a lovely footballer.
There was a couple of moments where they just didn't know what to do with him. They were kind of almost standing off him. And I also enjoyed Müller's celebration for his goal. It was like he'd scored the best overhead kick he'd ever seen, rather than hit someone's arse and went in the other corner. But it was, he's hilarious, isn't he?
The feeling I got with Bayern last night as well, and this is why I think at least, as someone who doesn't watch Bayern all the time, it was quite difficult to judge how good Bayern are because of the context of Barcelona. But one of the things that was so striking last night was Bayern were playing right into the Barcelona penalty area and not wanting to shoot until that Müller shot, which went in pretty much. And it was as if they just knew they got this. All right, it's okay. You don't need to force this. You don't need to chase this. You don't need to really push at this. It will just happen because we are just better than them. And it felt a little bit like Bayern only scored the third goal because, having put a load of kids on, Barcelona woke up for about 10 minutes. And it felt like Bayern sort of looked around and thought, oh, right, you want to play again, do you? And they were so much playing within themselves, so much in control after that 15 first minutes, which were pretty good from Barcelona, that it just felt like if they'd needed to, they could have scored 5 or 6 last night. And genuinely, I was thinking after the game last night, I was thinking, Barca played better in the 8-2 than they did last night.
Because we forget they were actually quite dangerous going forward in the first half, certainly, before it all went weird in that game.
They were. They really were. Yeah.
I thought Upamecano was very good for Bayern. And I think that's something that's been added to their whole thing this season in a little bit about. They've lost a lot of experience in Jerome Boateng going, in Alaba going, but in Upamecano they have a centre-half who's physically quite extraordinary. Like, he can really move, and he's really strong in the challenge. And they were pushing that back four right up, partially because, as we mentioned, Luke de Jong isn't going to threaten them much in behind, but also because they have so much recovery speed there in Davis, in from the left, and in Upamecano. And I think that's something we're going to see more this season, not just against Luke de Jong, basically.
Yeah, that was always a bit of a weakness for Bayern, wasn't it? I remember when Liverpool knocked them out a couple of years ago, that was really exposed. Upamecano is just... was amazing, and he's going to emerge as probably one of the best defenders in the world.
Is it wrong that every time I see Upamecano's name, I think there must be a way of getting Oops up inside your head as a song that fits his name somehow? And I really want fans to work on this and try and get it right.
It doesn't scan. I just think
Upamecano. I think it sort of does. Upamecano, Upamecano. It doesn't quite, but I've been working on this and trying to think. The right set of fans, I'm sure they can get this.
It's got one too many syllables, I think, isn't it, for a football song? Or maybe two.
Upamecano was that Lego that I just wasn't clever enough for. I never got past just Lego.
Duplo was that Lego that I wasn't clever enough for.
But they're big, satisfying blocks, aren't they, Duplo? Everyone's happy with a Duplo. The other game in this group, Dinamo Kiev 0, Benfica 0. This was the game, Lars, where Anthony Taylor accidentally sent someone off, wasn't it?
Big fan of that. You love to see it. I guess, with the best will in the world, not the most exciting game. Benfica had quite a few chances and probably, had the most possession. Dinamo Kiev kind of came into it towards the end and were a little bit dangerous. But I do think the main, for neutrals, the biggest takeaway probably was Anthony Taylor booking Denis Yarmash and then giving him a second yellow, only to discover he hadn't given him a first yellow at any point. I mean, he wasn't on a yellow. Very, very mystified Dinamo Kiev player who was confused getting his second yellow and a red card, having not gotten a first yellow at any point. And there was a late goal ruled out by VAR for what looked like quite a tight offside, and that is obviously very frustrating. That's how that one went.
Thanks, Lars. Perfect. Yeah. No need to say any more. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea 1, Zenit 0. Romelu Lukaku's first Champions League go for Chelsea. Do you know what? I'm almost as bored of Romelu Lukaku's stats about goals he's scoring as I am for distances in time between Ronaldo's last goal and... He was away for 12 years. Of course there's going to be some... It's just that is a, anyway, that is a stat. I'm not blaming you, producer Ian, for putting it in. I'm blaming myself for reading it out. But point is, Lars, is Romelu Lukaku is, he is the difference for Chelsea again. And he's started the season so brilliantly.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And Chelsea weren't amazing here. Certainly not as good as they can be, which was the case against Villa as well. But with Lukaku, they just have this focal point in their attack that maybe they missed last year. After Tuchel came in, obviously they improved a lot and won the Champions League and all that, but there were some games where they just weren't creating enough chances going forward, and where the lack of a sort of inverted commas proper number nine, proper center forward, I think was felt. And the thing about having Lukaku, obviously he's good enough technically and fast enough to be a threat in behind, and he can be part of that normal sort of build up that they do. But with him, you also have the opportunity. You know what? If nothing's really going for you, you can swing in crosses, and then there's every chance he'll power one in, and he did in this game. And it was such a great example of that little bit of extra he adds to this team. It's just another sort of tool in the toolbox of winning football matches. That said, they were a little bit fortunate not to concede a late equaliser when Artem Dzyuba really should have gotten the end on the end of a low cross. But, I mean, he isn't the fastest Dzyuba. And then poor Mendy in the Chelsea goal basically had several hundred pounds of sort of thick-cut Russian beef crash into him, which must have been quite uncomfortable.
Where's Dzyuba on the Luke de Jong scale? I mean, I think he's
bigger and slower.
That would be a race. I'm all in favour of the Rumbelow sprint challenge, but with big target men coming back. I would absolutely love to see that.
If Ronaldo is a siege weapon, I mean, he's a siege weapon that doesn't actually have wheels. Like, he has to be, you have to put, like, the logs in under and sort of push him and then replace the logs. And it's like, it takes a long time to move him into place. But also, he also can be very effective, but, you know, he's not fast, is he?
I was just going to say, Young Boys had a player yesterday who was called Hefty, didn't they? But he wasn't very big.
He wasn't
very big. I was disappointed with that.
Well, get him signed by Barcelona, play him alongside Fatty.
That would be excellent.
Like a nominative determinism 11 would be quite useful, wouldn't it?
But Young Boys would fare very poorly in a nominative determinism 11 because they weren't actually that young. In fact, it was Red Bull Salzburg was the young team on the night. They had one player over 24, RB Salzburg.
Back to Chelsea, Ed. They won this thing last year and they are better.
Yeah, and the thing about Lukaku, everybody's been saying he's the missing piece of the jigsaw. I think I've heard it maybe like 100 times. I think I've probably read it myself as well. So no, I'm not criticising everybody because he is. But it's a funny jigsaw that wasn't completed, that won the Champions League last season. I know that they can get better and that, you know, the Premier League is, you know, the target this year. But, you know, they weren't that bad last season is my point. And yeah, but obviously adding Lukaku to that has given them an extra dimension, and he's absolutely phenomenal. He's the perfect striker for them, isn't he? Whereas, you know, comparing to Ronaldo and United, yeah, he might score a lot of goals for them, but does he ultimately fit into the system? Not as well as Lukaku does at Chelsea, certainly.
And their strength in depth. When we looked at the Barcelona bench, we were like, wow, there's not a lot there. And Chelsea's, you know, having Kante and Havertz and Werner and Barkley and Chilwell is like extraordinary, isn't it? A couple of people got in touch about Timo Werner. Simon says, does Max still believe Werner will come good even if he can't get on the pitch? And Zosia says, will I ever see Timo Werner start for Chelsea again? I've an unexplainable love for this German. I'm tired of being angry at Tuchel whenever they post a starting 11. I feel the same. I just have this feeling that he will come good. He is destined eventually to score hundreds of goals, even if he lacks the composure that you need to do that.
Can I just, as a hopeless hypothetical, really, but I do wonder if he'd gone to Liverpool instead and played under cheerleader Jurgen Klopp and sort of rotated with Salah and Mane, if that sort of system would have actually suited him a bit better, I wonder.
So he's not going to come good for Chelsea. Is that what you think?
Well, maybe. He's a really good player, Werner. But there's a lot of competition there now, obviously. So,
yeah, I really thought he would dovetail with Lukaku and Havertz sort of Berbatoffing away, just, you know, on his own.
He's the sort of striker who could maybe be better in a two, isn't he? Maybe him and Lukaku would be good, but I don't think Tuchel would ever try that. You know,
they did. I mean, he played a lot playing off big Yusuf Poulsen in RB Leipzig. I mean, that's very much his role there. So he did like having a big, you know, big physical reference point. What he really wants to do is play next to Luke de Jong, I think.
Don't we all?
Also in that group, Juve won 3-0 at Malmo. They took the lead against a run of play in a way, I think, through Alexandro's 23rd minute header. Tommy saying, in the spirit of that header for Juve against Malmo, which was roughly a foot off the ground, what's the lowest headed goal that very, very much should have just been kicked? Producer Anthony noting Gianluca Vialli's for Sampdoria against Bari, which I confess I had not remembered from 91-92, which is very low. And you guys all came up with some. You all put them in the group. Ed, what was yours?
Mukhtar Falata, yeah, for Al-Ittihad against Al-Shabaab. In 2014.
Did you Google lowest header? You didn't. It didn't spring to mind.
No, it didn't. No, I cheated. Sorry.
All right.
But it was
a
good one. Come on.
Yeah, it was a very. It was a very low header. Adam says, a question for Lars. After seeing Juventus winless in Serie A beat Molde 3-0, how good are Molde? And does that mean Juventus are good again?
I mean, they haven't beat Molde. Molde are not in the Champions League. They beat Malmo, which is very different and geographically they're really far away from each other.
Very good point.
Dreadful.
It's a very good point.
Molde is a very small town on the west coast of Norway. Malmo is a considerably bigger town, just next to, across the way from Copenhagen. So, very,
of course, because that's where Sagan Arena is.
Right across the bridge, yeah. Which is, absolutely. If you're going to Malmo, it's really usually a lot easier to fly to Copenhagen and get the train than flying to Malmo because there are not as many flights.
Travel tips. It's like having travel tips. The panel today, Simon Calder.
But no, listen, this was one of those games where I think Malmo did a lot, you know, from I was multi-watching, but from what I could gather, they were doing quite a lot right, actually. But Juventus just had a lot, just a bit of extra class going forward and scored goals, which is what kind of often happens with teams from smaller countries when they play in Europe. I mean, as much as we love seeing young boys give United a hiding, it does happen quite frequently that there's just not enough individual quality to convert the chances and to keep the opponents out. And it's how it goes. Juventus isn't the games where Malmo are going to be hoping really to get points there. I mean, I think the healthy way to look at this is that it's kind of a playoff between them and Zenit for the Europa League spot in this group. And anything else is a bonus.
And what you're suggesting is really Molde have no chance in this competition.
Molde are, nowhere near. No chance at all.
Group G. Sevilla, RB Salzburg, the kids of Salzburg, the teenagers, was an extraordinarily... Well, the first half was just ridiculous. Salzburg missed a penalty. Salzburg scored a penalty. Salzburg missed another penalty. Sevilla scored a penalty. Sid, will Sevilla be disappointed not to... I mean, they shouldn't be disappointed because they conceded three penalties in the first half, but that's just mad, isn't it?
Yeah, they were disappointed, and Lopetegui was furious as well. But you look at the decisions, and actually there's probably not anything really wrong with them. And then you've got the biblical storm at the end of it all as well. I think Sevilla, it's difficult to know exactly where Sevilla are going to be because they, on the face of it, and I know this seems to be sometimes more important than the football itself, on the face of it, they won the transfer window. Now they've got a lot of new players in. Even players you don't know, you have a habit of trusting when it's Sevilla because everyone trusts Monchi, the sporting director. And so, you know, he buys seven players you've never heard of. And just the very fact that he's bought them makes you go, oh, seven brilliant signings there. And of course, they're not always brilliant. But the other thing is that they kept hold of Koundé, although he was furious about that, Koundé, because he wanted to go. But they didn't ultimately get the bid for him. So there was, I think, a sense that this is a Sevilla team that could compete for the league and could do something pretty good in the Champions League. So this is a disappointing result from their point of view, although it's early. And also just that sense that we're not quite seeing this Sevilla that could compete for everything yet.
But of course, as we know, this Salzburg team are full of children who are all hopped up on Red Bull. So, I mean, that's not necessarily easy. They're all sort of swarming around, being annoying. It's not necessarily an easy opponent.
Lille drew 0-0 with Wolfsburg. I don't know if anyone has anything important to say about
this football
match.
Important, actually.
Okay, good. Well, in which case, let's end part two and we'll do a bit more La Liga in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Sid, since you're here, and you know, who knows, you might take another month off for all I know. How's La Liga going? You know, we've got Real playing Inter and Atleti playing Porto tonight, but how's the league in general begun?
Well, it's begun with a feeling that it could be really, really competitive this year. That Madrid, Barcelona, Atletico, Sevilla could all win it. That Real Sociedad and Villarreal might not be very far off them. Partly, of course, driven by a belief that, that Madrid and Barcelona are vulnerable. I suspect that, that Madrid's starting 11 will be really, really good, but there's not a huge amount of strength in depth. Obviously, the thing that really took everybody's attention was Griezmann at the end of the transfer window going back to Atletico. Then you got the first game for him away at Espanyol, and Cholo Simeone came up with this slightly bizarre formation, which felt very much like an attempt to crowbar him in. So you had Griezmann playing on the left-hand side of a midfield three almost for most of the game. And to be perfectly honest, it didn't work. And then that brings up that other question, doesn't it? Which is when you've got a really good team and you buy a really good player, we always assume, oh, well, they're going to be great then. But sometimes it sort of doesn't quite fit.
Cool, you've got a feel for Griezmann to go somewhere else and have to be crowbarred in after just the ultimate crowbarring. That's not fair on him, is it?
Well, I mean, I think we sometimes forget that Griezmann's a bloody brilliant footballer. Or was a bloody brilliant footballer. We'll see if he still can be. He went to Barcelona at a time when, genuinely, he was probably in the top five or six players in the world. He went to Barcelona, which possibly the only person in the world that plays better in his positions than him was already there. You could have gone to just about any other club and you would have played in your position. But Barcelona had this little Argentinian geezer who was a bit good at doing that. And now, obviously, in the meantime, he's gone away. Atletico have gone and won things without him. Atletico have won more than him in the time that he wasn't at Atletico. It's going to be very interesting to see how they work this out, because the way they did it at Espanyol at the weekend just isn't a solution.
On Monday night, Everton climbed to fourth in the Premier League. Ed emailed, following Andros Townsend's performance on Monday night, can I formally request you put my Guardian subscription fee towards Troy being on the pod for every Toffees game? John says, was Andros Townsend inspired to cut inside and bang one in by your introduction of his dad on the pod? And Richard said, given how well Andros Townsend played this week, please would you consider inviting Joel Linton's dad on your next pod? But it was a brilliant goal from Townsend, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, he's doing so well, isn't he? I think a lot of people would written him off. Most Crystal Palace fans were. I mean, we were quite, you know, happy with what he'd given us, but not that sad to see him leave, really, to be honest, because, you know, looking to the future. But he's really impressed, and, you know, he puts in a shift. That's one thing you can always say about Andros. And he's still got quite a good trick when it comes off, going back to his heroics for Roy Hodgson back in the day and all of that. It's pretty difficult to stop it, even though you know it's going to happen. So, yeah, good for him. And I think Everton actually are quite... I know they're obviously doing very well. They've had a good start to the season. But with Rafa there, you could imagine them having a pretty good season. You know, they're solid. They'll be solid at the back. They'll get them playing a certain way that they're used to. And I think they've got as good a chance as, you know, they've had in any recent season of finishing, you know, maybe top six, if it all goes well.
Higher than seventh. Higher than the Everton Cup, it's possible.
Yeah, higher than seventh.
Yeah, they did play well, didn't they? Well done to them. Target says, after Klopp complained about the lenient refereeing against Burnley, the panel, especially Barry, said that he was simply moaning to gain an advantage. After Harvey Elliott's injury and various violent Burnley tackles being unpunished against Everton, will you concede that Jurgen Klopp had a point, Lars?
Yeah, I thought he had a point at the time. I didn't accuse him of whinging at all. I think, to put it very, very simply, and maybe too simply, I mean, if you're playing a team that has better players than you, one of the things you can do to level the distance is to start kicking them, which is why someone like Sean Dyche is very happy with this new license to kick. Whereas if you're Jurgen Klopp or you're Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and you have better players than a lot of your opponents, you're less happy because you're going to get kicked around more. And, you know, maybe people are very happy with this sort of let it flow thing, but I think it will come at the expense of more bad injuries. That's completely inevitable. And it's too simple to just go and say, we don't like the really bad tackles like the Tarkowski. We just want, you know, once you tell the players, we're not going to give as many free kicks, you sort of put it in their mind that they can take more risks in sort of the challenges. So even if the Tarkowski on Richarlison is terrible in any setting, you open the door for that sort of thing by saying, oh, we're not going to give as many fouls and we're not going to really follow the rules of the game anymore and just let it flow. It is a very dangerous route to go down. Maybe it's better for TV, that's possible, but it's certainly not very good for player welfare.
A question for you, and asked from Spain, where, of course, the refereeing bar is set a lot lower in terms of what's a foul. Why did they feel the need to do this anyway? Had English football genuinely got to the point where it was two-stop start? Had it lost the flow? Because, and as you know, look, I say this from Spain. Every time I watch a Premier League game, it already felt much quicker than Spain, much less stop-start than Spain, much more flow than Spain. It didn't feel like this was a burning need, or those of you who are watching it more often, was it?
Isn't this a continuation of just from the Euros when they had a directive to, you know, let the game flow a bit more and it's being brought into the Premier League? I
always felt, I mean, again, from sort of seeing from Spain, I always felt like what happened at the Euros was in a way a kind of way of saying, let's do what happens in England, where it flows a bit more. So from a Spanish, certainly from a Spanish point of view, one of the things that's often said here is what people enjoy, what those Spaniards who watch English football say, what they enjoy about the Premier League is that it's not stopping all the time. And that Euros, in a way, was just a reflection of that culture rather than this culture. And so therefore, England kind of already had it, if you see what I mean. They didn't need to then announce that, hey, let's do it even more.
I don't recall there being a huge debate about this last year. I don't recall people turning off in their droves because there were too many free kicks given. I don't think that happened. I guess what we could say, and the examples they brought up on Sky, was that, you know, perhaps there were too many annoying occasions of players just starting to buy fouls. You know, when players are between the opponent and the ball, they'll just sort of initiate a bit of contact and fall down and expect to get a foul. Maybe there was a bit much of that, but
I think there were a few very soft penalties. If I remember last season well enough, I can barely remember what happened yesterday, but, and I'm quite tired. I haven't mentioned that, but but there were just those moments where there was a really soft challenge in the box and the ref went and checked it. And I think that's what they've ironed out. And I think I quite like that. Having said that, we saw in the Bayern-Barca game, Lewandowski got pushed over. And if he goes down, it's a penalty. And he didn't go down, he didn't get a penalty. I don't know how to solve it. I must admit, I've been quite enjoying the game flowing, but I don't want people to get hurt. So... Also, you mentioned Sky. I thought it was quite good. They did an interesting debate on who was better, Lionel Messi or Cristiano.
You say interesting.
Sits head in his hand.
It was very interesting seeing Gary Neville sort of point to a big graphic that shows that Messi have scored more goals than Ronaldo and fewer of them were penalties, and used Ronaldo's goal scoring as an example of why he's better than Messi. That was quite something. In terms of stretching the logic, that was pretty magnificent.
I mean, there's. Is there not just? I've just lost the will to live. Forget it.
So you saw it.
I didn't.
Anyway, look. I think they're quite good.
Who won? Who won?
Well, I know. I think the problem was that they'd Ronaldo. I think one of them was going for Ronaldo and one for Messi. I only saw that there's some criticism because under international honours, Ronaldo got European Championships and the Nations League, and Messi got none. And Messi won the Copa America quite recently. And so, anyway, now speaking of honours, Kevin Keegan has many in his career, of course. Ballon d'Or twice, European Cup, winning the league three times, and the UEFA Cup. All those brute adverts as well. And now this, with thanks to, we're not the first people to mention this, football cliches, of course. Quickly, Kevin have done it. Paul Hawksby and Charlie Baker did it. Kevin Keegan hosted this year's Meat Management Industry Awards on the 9th of September and has spoken to Meat Management about mastering the barbecue and the psychology of taking first place. But what I really liked about it was the questions that they ask Kevin Keegan about meat management, which are obviously like, what are you asking Kevin Keegan? Why are you asking Kevin Keegan about meat is the question. Question one, Kevin, what attracted you to hosting the Meat Management Industry Awards? You'd be surprised to know Kevin Keegan didn't at any point say, you're paying me some money to host the Meat Management Awards. He just said, award nights are such good fun because people are being selected and rewarded for what they've done that year, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, that's question nice. Yeah, he wanted to do it because it was fun.
Question two to Kevin Keegan. What's your view of the UK meat industry's performance during the pandemic? How does Kevin Keegan know?
I hope he did his research before he turned up.
Well, do you want the answer?
Yeah, please.
Yes.
It's coped very well with it. You keep hearing that there are going to be problems and reading things in the papers that some supplies are going to be affected, but it seems the meat industry always survives. And sometimes you wonder how. It keeps reinventing itself. How is meat reinventing itself? How is sausages? Who's reinvented pork chops? We're living in times when people are looking at meat and diet and every industry is under scrutiny. But from what I gather, the meat industry has coped with the pandemic very well and seems to be coming out the other side even stronger.
Coming out the other side when we're talking about meat.
Tell us about your favourite cut of meat. Anybody want to hazard a guess? Kevin Keegan's favourite meat.
He likes a steak. He likes a...
there you go. Yeah. 10 out of 10. I'm a steak man and I like to barbecue. If anyone has supported the meat industry this year, it's been my family, says Kevin Keegan.
Can I just stop you there? Given that this is the Meat Industry Awards, a specialist event, right?
Yeah.
Surely those meat specialists are going to be deeply disappointed when they ask Kevin Keegan quite specifically what his favourite cut of meat is, and he just says steak. Yeah. Which cut of steak, Kevin? There are lots of different types of steak. Which one was it?
He seems to be a sirloin man in my head. You know, not fancy enough for the fillet all the time, but rump steak's a bit too tough for him.
This is what Adam Hurry really liked. If anyone's supported the meat industry this year, it's been my family. With the good weather, we had a...
So I've got this image now of the entire Keegan family. It makes my ham garage look pathetic. It's just got carcasses of cows everywhere.
He's just, if you go into his house, it's like that scene in Rocky. It's just carcasses hanging down. With the good weather, we had a run of about 5 barbecues in 6 days. That's really a lot of barbecues, isn't it?
And next week, Kevin Keegan at the colonoscopy awards.
I would have thought Mark Langdon has also helped. I would say steak is my favourite, but I like a lamb chop and a sausage on the barbecue. Then they go into football questions, which frankly we are not interested in. So
5 barbecues in 6 days is formidable.
I might have come close to that this summer, to be honest. In our week-long summer, that was.
Do you not just crave some sushi or something at some point? Like, you need to lighten this shit up.
It's not always heavy stuff. You can have a bit of chicken or some fish on a barbecue. It doesn't have to be.
Right. Let me tell you, when I was supposedly on holiday but working, I went to Bilbao for their first game of season. In the airport, I've looked this up now because I wanted to make sure I didn't get it wrong. In the airport on the way back, they actually have a thing called Beef Magazine, written in English, exclamation mark.
Well, right? You should, and rightly so.
Beef. But they have absolutely fantastically punny headlines on the front cover. I mean, you know how, I mean, obviously you must have a limitation. It's a bit like Men's Health, where every single front cover is about a six pack. Every front cover is some sort of beef related pun. For some reason at the airport, they had two different episodes of the Beef Editions. Magazine. Edition is the word I'm looking for. Thank you. Yeah. So I'd love to see a years long spread of these. But those two were, one of them was about how it's been tough during the pandemic. And it actually said The headline was Raw Time. We've been for a Raw Time. Very good, very good. Okay, another one was about how people have to get new ideas and you know, think of new things to do with beef and think carefully and be more adult about it. And the headline was actually Time You Matured, with a picture of a very mature bit of beef. And obviously, you can just go down a massive rabbit hole of terrible puns. But, you know... You get a magazine and you fill it with great ideas, and it's just amazing. So I'm really, really, really looking forward to getting a subscription to beef.
surely you're publicly the biggest advocate of Beef magazine. You'd hope that they would send you, unless of course, I mean, I've got Kevin Keegan's number. He could be a guest columnist
for Beef magazine.
Yeah, he could. Couldn't he?
Today I had yet another barbecue. It's been 350 now in the last year.
We grill Kevin Keegan on the issues of the day.
Oh my God.
That's it. I think we should end now. I'm going home.
I think we should. We'll end. That'll do for today's pod. Ed, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Sid.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
We're back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.